Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Evelyn.
And this is Lisa.
And we are here with Kitty Zeldis, who wrote a book called Not Our Kind. Hi, Kitty. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi. So happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. So I read the book.
So did I.
I really enjoyed it.
So did I.
It's a great story, great Jewish story.
Yes,
which is what I liked about it a lot.
Based in New York City, of course.
Right. We like New York City and we love historical fiction.
Well, good.
So it's got all the components of the books that we all love.
Yes.
So we're just curious to know, is this book based on actually any real things that happened to you in your life or that you were told stories about?
Well, novels are always a mixture, at least for me, of things that actually happened and things that I invent. But they have to come from some place. Some actual form of experience or feeling, otherwise I have no basis to write. And so yes, there definitely were things in this novel that tapped into my personal experiences.
Did you know anybody that had to change their last name?
I've heard of people doing that, although, you know, this book is set in the 40s, and I did that intentionally because I thought the kinds of issues that I was raising were even more sharply delineated in the 1940s. But I knew people who voluntarily changed their names, you know.
My grandfather did.
Yeah.
So
my husband's family did too.
See, yeah. So people who just thought it'd be easier to go through life with the name Gilmore rather than Goldberg. And they just did that. But they weren't forced to or, you know, coerced to in any way.
It was interesting how when I read Moss, because I actually had a teacher, Moss, and I started wondering
What her real name was. Okay, so tell us about what made you write about this. I know you went to Vassar.
I did. I went to Vassar in the 1970s, and I loved Vassar. It was a remarkable intellectual experience, and it wasn't sort of a natural choice for me. I'm probably one of the few young girls whose father said, "I'm really disappointed in you," when I told him I was going there. My father was a Zionist and kind of a socialist, and he just thought it was this elitist place, and that's not where I should be. But I did go, but it was my first encounter with, like, wasps and en masse. Like, the Christians I knew growing up in Brooklyn were Irish Catholics or Italian Catholics. And, you know, they were kind of on a level with us.
Similar, yes, absolutely.
And many of them went to the local parochial school. The Jewish kids went to the public school. But, you know, we kind of knew each other from the neighborhood. Wasps were like a different thing, a breed apart. And they intimidated me. They fascinated me. I envied them. I disdained them. I was afraid of them. But I was curious about them. And what I realized from being there very quickly was that Vassar was a place, although as I said, I did find it welcoming, and there were Jewish students and Jewish faculty members, but it was a place built on excluding people like me. That Vassar was a place that was founded on excluding people like me, and that I was, in fact, the not our kind of this book's title. Once I knew that, it was not something I could not know anymore, and it really has shaped my understanding of what it is to be a Jew in a non-Jewish world, in a largely, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we are a minority. So in a world that we have to kind of fit into. And it's, I think there are particular issues, I mean, for me, like for Eleanor, if you are very religious, I think your community is something that protects you and buffers you and shelters you. And there are a lot of questions that are just naturally answered, like how you're going to raise your children, who you're going to marry, you know, how you're going to practice your faith. Like, all of those things are answered for you by that life. That's what that life does. It defines those things. But if you are a more assimilated Jew and a less observant one, as I was, then those questions are kind of thrown back at you, and you have to figure all that out. So, you know, I think that's been a question that's interested me my entire adult life. Like, what does it mean to be a Jew in this non-Jewish world, and how does that get expressed and lived out? And I don't know why at this moment I chose to write this novel. I can't really say. It started a number of years ago, and I had to put it aside for various reasons, so I'm not even sure I remember. But once I thought I got that idea, I really seized upon it. It was one of great interest to me.
Okay. You know what? Why don't we backtrack a little, and why don't you tell our listeners what the book's about?
Ah, well, the book is about two women, Eleanor Moskowitz and Patricia Bellamy. They both live on the Upper East Side, but it's a very different Upper East Side. Eleanor Moskowitz lives on 2nd Avenue, which was east of the L, and you did not want to be east of the L in those years. It was an elevated track, and it totally dominated the landscape. It was big, and it cast shadows. And Patricia lives on Park Avenue. And these two women never should have met, but they do, and their lives intersect in ways neither of them could have expected. And it's set in that post-war period.
Right.
And, if I had to give you a 25-word elevator pitch, I'd say it's gentlemen's agreement, but with women at the center. Same kinds of issues, same kinds of milieu. Mm-hmm.
And they can't believe that someone would live on 2nd Avenue. They keep saying they can't
right.
believe.
There's only stores on 2nd
yeah,
Avenue.
Right. Yes, I can't believe people.
I did live on 2nd Avenue
oh,
for
did?
A number of years with
okay.
my husband.
Okay.
On 2nd Avenue and 84th Street. So,
but has it changed since 1947?
Well, not only since 1947, since the 1980s when I lived there, it's quite different. It still felt more ethnic and more like a neighborhood. It was Yorkville.
Oh,
so there were like German shops and Hungarian, and that's kind of all practically all gone now. It's just been sort of made more
what's
generic.
What's there now?
Well, it's just like more generic, chains, the Gap, Starbucks, offices.
Like
banks,
all over New York
City. Like all over Manhattan.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't walk a block without a Starbucks or a nail salon.
That's right. Many nail salons.
Yeah, things have definitely changed.
Yeah, it's amazing. Every 40 years, it really changes.
So what kind of research did you have to do for Not Our Kind?
Well, I had already been, in effect, doing it in my love for films of that period and had seen a lot of, so I kind of knew what things looked like. But I did add to that, I got a lot of photographic books that I ordered, online. Amazon is the writer's best friend, that and Google.
Library?
The New York Public Library, actually, and I did a lot of research that I didn't end up using in this book because originally there was a rape in it and a trial, things that I eliminated. But I did a lot of research actually at the New York Public Library to see how rapes were covered in the newspapers. Like how were these cases and trials reported on? I wanted to know that. I thought that would be really interesting.
Did you have to do research on hats?
That just came naturally to me.
I love hats.
But yes, I did do research, and I found this wonderful first-person account. Apparently, there was a big hat-making industry in Danbury, Connecticut, which I did not know about, and a first-person account of a hat maker, and I used some of the details, like Irina gets a needle stuck in her arm, and I read that.
Still there, though.
It's still there, right? And she
you could live like that.
Yes,
it doesn't hurt
apparently
you at
can.
All.
And this person who was interviewed, they did have it taken out years later.
Okay.
But in her case, I decided to have her leave it in. But so this person lived with it for many, many years, and it didn't bother them. They just had this like needle embedded in their skin. It's weird, right?
Yes.
Like a chip.
Yeah, I would find that quite uncomfortable.
The idea of it sort of creepy,
I wouldn't
right?
even know the materials of the hats and everything.
I knew some of it just from my interest, but then I was able to research that, hat making as a... Several people have asked me, was there a milliner in my past? And I say, I only wish there had been.
Well, were the hats symbolic of the Jewish religion?
Well,
did
that's
you feel?
A good question.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that, but you're right. They do suggest that, don't they? And this is funny because I did a JCC event recently, and I wore a hat. I wore a hat here today.
Oh, okay.
But I took it off when I came in. But that day, I kept the hat on throughout the event. And several people asked me if I was Orthodox. And I said no, but I feel like in honor of this book, I like to wear a hat. I mean, I like wearing hats anyway, and that's why I wanted to write about them, but that I should be wearing hats when I go to speak about this book. And then one person did ask me if I'd had cancer. So that was the other association people had, and neither one was true. I am neither Orthodox nor a cancer
Thank
survivor.
God.
I
okay.
just like hats. And wear them at many on many opportunities.
Very nice. I mean, they're big now with all those fascinators in England. We see all the royals and all the weddings and everything they go to.
Yes.
Everybody wears
hats. Those are purely decorative, right?
Yeah. Well, we don't wear any of that here. No. So,
well, I did try on a hat with a veil, which is the most enchanting thing. But I cannot tell you how irritating it is to wear. It's like somebody's like doing this to you all day long. They're like in your face. I didn't buy it. I just thought, like, I love the idea of this, but I am not wearing, I'm just, like, not intentionally making an obstruction in my day.
But I feel like even when you look at photos from that time period, most men were always wearing hats. Like,
yes, that's true.
Yeah,
that's
it was
right.
Like, that was their thing. They just always,
that's
know.
Right.
Yeah, men wore hats.
Men everybody wore hats and gloves.
Yeah. And but gloves, yes.
It was Kennedy in the 60s that kind of did away. Yeah. I mean, he appeared in public.
People are dressed.
Right. With right. Oh, yes. They go out in their gotchas.
So one question I wanted to know is, how did your own experiences shape the characters you created? And why did you choose to set the novel in post-World War II New York?
Well, 1947.
Okay. Yeah. I will. I didn't want to set it during the war. I just thought there was something too obvious about setting it during the war, because of the anti-Semitism that we learned about, you know, in Europe. And after the war, like, several people had said to me, oh, I thought all that was resolved by the war, you know, and it wasn't. You know, those issues still existed. My working title for the book was Restricted, and that was a word that was used very openly and with pride by real estate agents and developers and people that had hotels and inns. This is something I researched, like brochures that said, come to our lovely restricted inn, or move to our lovely restricted neighborhood. And that was very, what it clearly meant was, you don't like those people? Don't worry, they're not gonna be here. You don't have to deal with them. So that was why I chose that period. I thought that that would really, you know, bring the issues into sharper focus. And the first part of your question was, oh, the two characters? And
how did you shape the characters you created? How did your own experiences shape the characters
you
created?
Well, they kind of come to me like I'm hearing voices. Eleanor was the more obviously, you know, the one more that with whom I had the greater affinity in terms of background and experience. But Patricia, I felt like, was a woman I had, you know, been watching since I was a girl at Vassar, like those WASPy girls. How did they get to be so confident and so easy in the world? I was fascinated by them, and she was one of those girls.
Do you think her struggle with the divorce was more how she would be perceived, or do you think she was still in love with Wynn?
I think she felt regret at where that love had taken her and what it had become. But yes, that was a time that there was much greater stigma attached to being divorced. And, you know, she had a place for herself in the world as a married woman, and she was going to have to surrender that if she divorced him.
I think she was afraid of not being invited to places.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She also was afraid of how it would affect her daughter, how Margot, right?
Yes, uh-huh. And that is always true in a divorce, even now.
Yes.
But the stigma has, you know, been largely erased.
Yes, very much so. When more than 50% of all marriages end in divorce.
Right.
It's a little different now, absolutely. Now, what about Tom? He was such a suave character.
Yes.
Is he based on anyone you know?
No one in particular, just bits and pieces. You know, we're sort of, I shouldn't say that. Some writers do base characters directly on people they know. But I have never done that. I'm more like a blue jay. You know, they pick things out as they like them. They find shiny things and bring them back to their nests. So that's what I feel like I'm doing. I'm finding a little detail here and something there and something else I like, and I'm bringing it all together and creating this character out of it.
You know, I've noticed that sometimes I thought he was younger than Patricia, and other times I didn't even realize it until, like, later that he was older.
He is older, but yes. He has a boyish kind of,
yes.
You know, yeah, also I irresponsible quality.
Right. He doesn't even have to work.
He doesn't, he just kind of floats around. I'm just going to hang out up here.
Right.
So there was plenty of money on both sides,
right.
I guess, on Wynn's side and on Eleanor's side.
Right. No, Patricia's side.
Patricia, I'm sorry, right. Not Eleanor.
The one thing I do admire is that he doesn't seem to care what other people think of him. Like, he's like, they're like, well, what would they think about you hanging out with this guy? Oh, well, I don't care what anyone thinks of me. And I really thought, you know, for that time period, that was big.
Well, that's true. Yeah. He's, you know, he sort of represents that.
Very opposite of sister,
yes,
with that.
Right.
All.
Right. But he's also a man, and men, you know, had greater freedom and still have greater freedom.
That's true.
Do you think they will actually get married, Eleanor and Tom?
I have been asked that many times, and I wanted them to be married. I wanted them to be together, but I felt to write that would, in a sense, be to undercut everything else I'd written. I don't know if those problems can be resolved. I didn't want to write a book that says, yes, love conquers all. I don't know that it does.
Right.
You know, I do think that people have to be, not have to be, but let's just say they experience problems when they are from disparate backgrounds and they can't really incorporate one another's experiences into their own. And that could create trouble for them.
Right. But Patricia seemed to be more concerned with what Wynn was going to feel about that.
Yes. Right.
And then once she was going to divorce Wynn, you would think that maybe it would have been okay.
Well, I
could have been. We don't know because we don't really know.
Right.
For sure what happens.
It's funny how Patricia does this. She's like, well, of course Eleanor will say yes. You know,
she right. Like, well, she thought she was, you know, a gold digger.
That's what her husband kept telling her.
Right. That's what she was after from the beginning.
Yes.
And in fact, that is what Eleanor wants at the beginning, but for different reasons.
Right.
You know, she really does love this man and wants... Yes. And that's the culmination. You know, that's what she's been brought up to expect and to plan for. But in the course of the novel, I like to think that she's changed and she's not so sure that that's what she wants.
She's pretty sure it's not what she wants.
Yeah.
I think she really loved the idea of living on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once she got that taste of living on her own, she's like, well, why do I want to go and deal with that again?
Yeah, when she moved into that apartment, all I could think of is, like, the honeymooners. Like, an apartment, like, the honeymooners
right.
were in. Like, that kind of apartment.
Right. A walk-up.
A walk-up on...
With just like one room.
Which is kind of the apartment I had with my husband. It was more than one room, but it was a railroad flat
right.
on Second Avenue above a restaurant that used to take our UPS packages. They were very nice. We were on very good terms with them.
What kind of food was it?
It was called the Wicked Wolf. It was a bar. You know, it was like the Second and Third Avenue, yes, or filled with those kind of, in those years, those kinds of bars that attracted a college crowd. They didn't card people too carefully.
Right.
So you could have a fake ID and drink all you wanted. And there's actually one of them, Dorian's Red Hand. It was just down the street that was implicated in this terrible murder in Central Park. Robert Chambers.
Yeah, I remember
that's
that.
That's where those two had met.
They used to hang out.
The two had met there, and then they went off to the park together, mm-hmm. and she ended up dead. That poor girl.
Yeah, that was a horrible story. Don't write that one.
I don't want to write that one.
That's not a good one. So what kind of book are you working on now?
It's actually another historical. I've sort of developed a taste for this.
That's great.
And this one is set in 1916 and 1917 in New Orleans, which it's more of a challenge because of the year and more of a challenge because of the place. I've been to New Orleans twice, once a long time ago and fell in love with it, and then once recently to do research. But, you know, how long was I there for? Not that long. So that part is a challenge. And then just researching things in 1916 and 17, there's simply less of a visual record available. You don't have movies from that time period that were made then, right, that you can see. Maybe very few. There might be a few movies, but not like the 1940s, right, that, you know, there's just this outpouring of films and great films. But it takes place in the district, Storyville. It's about a madam. A Jewish madam.
Wow.
I had read something about that there were Jewish prostitutes in New Orleans, and I thought, what? What? What do you mean there were Jewish prostitutes? Like, I don't know that immigrant story. Like, my family was all immigrants, and I know their story, and I know lots of other immigrant stories. Jews that went through Cuba or South America before they got to the United States. You know, all kinds of different stories. But I did not know the story of Jewish women becoming prostitutes in New Orleans. And because I am a novelist and not a historian, I don't have to, hew that closely to the facts. I get to make things up. So I invented a background for this woman, like how she got to be that person.
Very nice and interesting. So your other books were not historical fiction?
No. I've written books. This is a pseudonym. So I've written books under another name.
I have the name. Can I say it?
Sure.
Yona Zeldis McDonough.
That's it.
Okay. And it says you've written 7 adult novels and 28 books for children.
Yes. I have done that. And the most recent of those novels, The House on Primrose Pond, had a historical component that took place in 18th century New England and involved the very unlucky, tragic figure of Ruth Blay, who had the dubious, I can't say honor, but distinction of being the last woman hanged in the state of New Hampshire in 1768. And she was accused of murdering her newborn baby. She was not convicted of that, but what she was convicted of and executed for was concealing the birth of an illegitimate child, which was a capital offense in these colonies. This was not even the United States yet. And this was an English rule, and an English law, and we were under English rule. And the governor, who gave her reprieves, which suggests that he really did not want to do this. He did not want to execute this 32-year-old woman who maintained that she did not kill her baby and really did not sound like she killed her baby. But, you know, he was under the British law, and he had to uphold it, and so he did. So sections of that novel were written from that point, from somebody's point of view back then. And I found that I liked that the best of all. I loved writing that part. So I thought, like, the next one I'm going to just do, like, all in the past.
Oh, okay. Now, I love the cover. I'm sorry our listeners can't see the cover, but it's a very fashionable looking woman wearing a pink dress with her hair up, not the way any of us would ever wear it now, looking over the New York skyline. How did you get such a great cover?
I don't have much to do with the cover. I love the cover too. But I was shown several designs, early designs, and while I loved the concept, the earlier designs looked like the woman was playing dress up, like she was going to a Halloween costume and she was trying to look like she was from the 1940s. And I said, you know, maybe I could send you some images, you know, that I can cull of actual clothes and hairstyles and hats from that period. And I did that, and they used them.
Oh, wow.
So I was very appreciative that they,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, because I hear they don't usually give you a lot of input in the cover.
They really don't give you any.
Right.
I think it was just very nice that they did.
It was HarperCollins.
Yes, they've been great to work with.
HarperCollins is a good publishing house there. And our books, the copies we had, were all out. I had to go to another library to get my copy.
I love to hear that.
Yeah.
I don't want them to sit on the shelf.
No,
go out.
And originally
people.
When I looked, they
get
had
read.
Two copies on the shelf. And when I went, there was only one. So
okay.
That means
well,
the other one
right.
went out, too. So I was like, wow, I'm so glad I got the one copy I need. And I enjoyed it. It was a really, really
Thank
nice
you.
Story. I also saw that you'll be at Book Expo 2020 this year. Is that correct?
I didn't know that.
Oh, I saw it. Really? Okay. It
okay.
came up when I was researching.
Okay.
When I was researching you, it came up, Book Expo 2020, and your name was
when
there.
When is it?
In May.
In May.
The end of May, right.
My novel will not be written by then.
Oh, it won't
then.
Be done by then?
No.
Okay, so maybe it's not correct. I don't know.
I'm happy to go if I'm invited. I went last time. It was fabulous.
Right. Well, maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was from 2019, but it definitely said 2020.
No, I was there in, like, not even, I think... It must have been 2018.
Okay.
Because this came out in hardcover in the fall of 2018.
So you probably were there in 2018.
Right. So that would have been in the spring of 2018. That makes sense.
Did you just do a signing or?
Yes, I did a signing, but, you know, people were, like, lined up. I mean, they had obviously been getting some buzz about it or hearing something because they wanted copies.
HarperCollins does a lot of good, like, publicity.
They are
very good
great.
Marketing.
Can I say that? HarperCollins, you are the dream team. I love each and every one of you.
We like HarperCollins.
Yeah, we
They're
do, too.
Terrific. Well, that's good to know because I've worked with other publishers that, let's say, they shall remain nameless, but I had one instance where I was talking to my lovely editor, but she said, look, I know you're frustrated, but you know you don't want to make the people in PR and marketing feel like they're not doing a good job. And I said, what if they aren't doing a good job? Do we not get to say that?
Right.
Because they aren't. I never got an answer to that question.
Okay, but HarperCollins did a good marketing job.
A fabulous job. And very responsive to anything I ask for, you know, like, can you send a book here or can you contact this person? And they're just like, it's done. It's you know, before I even can blink, it's done.
That's great. I'm glad you found a good place to be.
Yes. Okay. Does it feel weird to be called Kitty though after?
No, because Kitty is my college nickname. Uh-huh. And I will tell you how that came about now that you know my other name. I had a very good friend who was actually he was a professor of mine at Vassar. It was his first year teaching and my last year in school. So
you guys were probably pretty close in age then. It wasn't a big age discrepancy.
He was 29.
Yeah.
So he was kind of like an older brother, you know. Can't even say uncle, but like a beloved older brother kind of steering me in the world. And he's still a friend of mine after 40 years. So I said to him, you know, I don't think Jonas Eldest belongs at Vassar. I think my name should have been Catherine Ann Worthington. And he said, Kitty! He just started calling me that.
Oh,
and
that's
he's been
cute.
Calling me that for all those years.
Oh.
And I know any number of people through him, and they all call me Kitty. So it is actually a nickname I've had for decades.
So that's great.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel strange.
So Zeldis was your maiden name.
Indeed.
Okay.
So well, it doesn't really feel strange
it's
at
not
all.
Such a, then it's not really a fake name.
No.
It's your real name. You just used a different name for your other book.
Right. Yes. A different part of it. Right.
Yes. Okay. And McDonough, your husband?
Yes.
Not Jewish.
The Irishman I married, yes.
So you really can relate to the story with
Absolutely.
Somebody falling in love with somebody not Jewish.
Yes, I mean, that wasn't such an issue in
your time.
In my time. Although, right.
Yeah, but even in this time, it's still an issue.
I think my mother was, you know, regretful in some way. She loves him and they get along really well. And my grandmother came to accept him very quickly and easily. She'd say, a prince. She married a prince. He was very good to her. She was a difficult woman. And he was very patient with her and very sweet with
That's
her.
That's nice.
It was very nice. And I'm sure that his family probably thought, I don't know, like, who is she? This, like, weird New York, fast-talking, hand-using. I mean, I don't think that there were... If there were Jews in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where he grew up, he didn't know them.
Right.
You know, there were not many.
Right. We met down here in New York City?
Yes. Yeah, he'd been in New York for a lot of years.
Right. That's very nice. Good. I'm glad to hear that. Now you guys live in Brooklyn.
We do. But it's not the Brooklyn of my childhood. It's a very different Brooklyn.
Are you in the same area? Or?
No, although I knew Park Slope then, and it always had a bit of a cachet. But the Brooklyn of my girlhood, I have described as a perpetual Sunday afternoon in August. It was a sleepy backwater. Now Brooklyn is very hip. I don't know if you know this.
Yes.
I was born in Brooklyn too, but I know nothing about it.
Well, there are you know, busloads of tourists from Berlin and Paris that come to Brooklyn.
Oh my God!
I'm like, oh my God, exactly.
Wow.
Any of us who grew up back then, we cannot wrap our minds around this, how this has happened. Mm. And neighborhoods have changed and gentrified and... Yes. My children live in neighborhoods that whose names you didn't utter, much less go to in those years. But there they are.
I was born in Crown Heights.
That's one of those neighborhoods that you don't, right? And now that is gentrifying, you know, as we speak.
Right.
You can
get
a lavender latte there.
Yes.
Because I have.
Oh, my God. I have to tell my mother that.
Tell her. She'll find it funny.
Absolutely.
How things change.
Well, Kitty, it's been a pleasure having you here. And we'd like to invite you back when your new book comes out.
Thank you.
And
I
we
will
can
come.
Do another Turn the Page recording. So this is Evelyn.
And Lisa.
And Kitty. Nice to talk to you.
Thank
both.
You so
Thank
much
you.
For coming. Okay. And this is another chapter of Turn the Page. Thank you.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.